On this one, before one, he begins his presentation, I think we need, as a committee, to do some serious thinking about where we're going with this. This is, Michael tells me, the third time we've had IFRS 11. Now, we've made some significant strides in other areas of it, but I think we need to have a hard, I think that we need to think hard about what the output of this is likely to be, and whether that's going to be worth the candle. Wonhe?
Thank you. Yes, agenda paper 5 is a cover note and describes what have been discussed in previous meetings for various issues related to IFRS 11 and what will be discussed in this meeting. Agenda paper 5A addresses the committee's request at its January 2014 meeting. We performed an analysis of how and why other facts and circumstances create rights and obligations that result in the joint arrangement being classified as a joint operation. In agenda paper 5B, we considered the application of IFRS 11 to some common joint arrangement structures. In agenda paper 5A, we first clarified how IFRS 11 provides guidance for how and why particular facts and circumstances create rights and obligations that result in the joint arrangement being classified as a joint operation. We noted that assessment of other facts and circumstances is made when the parties to the joint arrangement do not have direct rights to the assets and direct obligations for the liabilities relating to the joint arrangement. So if the assessment of other facts and circumstances can establish that the parties to the joint arrangement have other rights and other obligations, which can be considered to be in substance such direct rights and direct obligations, the joint arrangement would be classified as a joint operation. And we denoted such rights and obligations as inferred rights and inferred obligations. In analysis 1, we showed that how IFRS 11 provides criteria for inferred rights and inferred obligations. As for inferred rights, we think that the parties to the joint arrangement would have inferred rights when they have both rights to substantially all economic benefits of the assets of the joint arrangement and obligations to acquire those economic benefits, thereby assuming risks relating to those economic benefits. As for inferred obligations, we think that the parties to the joint arrangement, by being substantially the only source of cash flows to the joint arrangement, should be able to ensure the settlement of the liabilities of the joint arrangement and continue the operation of the arrangement. In addition, the parties need to settle the liabilities of the joint arrangement on a continuous basis. Based on this analysis, we also examined some specific issues which this paper addressed in analysis 2 to 5. You can see the summary of these analyses in paragraph 63 of this paper. In agenda paper 5B, we examined some common joint arrangement structures, which is often called as project entities. We note that such joint arrangements have some unique features. Particularly, we noted some features that indicate that the parties to the joint arrangement are closely involved with a separate vehicle. In our analysis, we consider each unique feature, assessing whether they suggest that the parties have inferred rights and inferred obligations. We also considered the features collectively, examining whether those features would create inferred rights and inferred obligations. We think that the unique features of the project entity do not create inferred rights and inferred obligations. However, as you see in Appendix A of this paper, we are still in the progress of considering some variations to the common features. In this regard, two companies wanted to provide input for our analysis, and we will reach out to them as we develop our analysis on these fact patterns. Consequently, we think that the requirements in IFRS 11 are consistent in terms of how to assess other facts and circumstances. However, we think that adding some examples to the standard would be helpful, considering divergent views regarding the assessment of other facts and circumstances. So we recommend the committee consider adding illustrative examples to IFRS 11. Thank you.
Martin?
I like the structure of the paper because, well, it illustrates that in many cases management judgment in IFRS 11 is, well, absolutely necessary. However, specifically with regard to this and going through the paper, for example, in paragraph 27, where we say it is the last sentence, in this situation, we think it would be necessary to assess whether the cash flows can ensure the continuity of the operation of the joint arrangement. I would agree to the sentence, but I would ask the question, so when? Only at the beginning or also at a later point in time? And if so, at a later point in time, I have to change my view. Does it have any implication whether I account for it as a joint operation or as a joint venture? So that would be one point. On number 44, again, we have a situation where we talk about, a cost price and market price, and we compare whether cost price would probably be below or above market price. And here, again, we have to do an estimation. But my question here would also be, so when and what would a change in the original estimation would have an impact on the subsequent accounting in later years? With regard to the third analysis, this is, for example, in number 49, we always talk about construction. And when I construct something, in general, I assume the output would be an asset or is an asset under development. Would we come to a different conclusion if we talk about R&D? Because in general, on R&D, where we have a low likelihood that we would be successful later on, and we would not end up with an asset out of the construction phase, and there are some guarantees given or so for financing under the construction phase and later on within the marketing phase, and this guarantee is only for the, say, development phase, would the outcome be different? Because in the whole argumentation here, we have the underlying belief that we are talking about, well, producing, well, hardcore accounting assets. At least that was my reading of it. Same probably is the analysis four when we talk about the nature of the output. Again, we have some assets which are the output. What is if the output is R&D? Last but not least with the fifth analysis, unit of account, I agree that the unit should be in monetary terms based on cash flows. But again, what happens over time if these cash flows are changing? If you have a production where you have two products, one predominant and one side products, two different parties, and prices might change over time dramatically. And what are the consequences for consolidation? So do I more or less change my share within the assets time by time, year by year, according to the value of the output? Or do I, well, do a kind of estimation at the beginning of the first, well, accounting, and then keep it constant over time? So I guess, and I believe these kinds of questions are also, well, out in practice. This could be, well, a good paper if we add on some further, well, hints, guidance, views, because I believe the question I had in the last 3 or 4 minutes are also the same which are out and in public and which will need to be solved in a way, otherwise we would end up in divergence in praxis.
Lokai, did you want to come in on this?
Oh, yeah. I think that the analysis performed is very useful, and my mind has clarified some issues that we have faced during the last couple of meetings. I find very useful agenda paper 5B, and I agree that the presentation of an illustrative example inside the standards could be useful. I think that the part covered by 5B is absolutely relevant in some entities, in some kind of industries, and the clarification performed are very useful. I agree with Martin that it's clear that there are some level of judgment, managerial judgment, that have to performed in the analysis. I have some doubts regarding cases in which, even though the entity sells the product to the third parties, but there are the production done derived from activities performed only by the two joint ventures before. This is quite similar and quite common in oil and gas industries, in which the two joint ventures provide the cash flow necessary for the exploration and the production activities, the development activities, and then later on they sell the product to third parties. According to this analysis, you will have a switch, because for part of your life it is a joint operation, and then will become a joint ventures, even though what you will receive from the sale, nothing is that's the recovery of the cost that you have sustained before. So I think that is another item that we could analyze more in depth, but I think that is really linked with the industry practice and so the level of judgment. So some clouds, there are at least in the interpretation, but I think that we are doing a step forward in order to clarify. I share your point that at some point we have to decide what we do at committee, because we are only at the first stage of the long list of points, and so we probably have to define a going a schedule activities or the way in which we want to go on, because I think that if we have to see all the 27 points, I think that we will spend another couple of years.
That's my concern.
Yes.
Okay, I think I've got Andrew, you're next.
Yes, you must, where are we heading with all of this? And this particular question is focusing on what is the other facts and circumstances test. And I think when you step back from it and add all the bits together, what essentially the analysis is pointing towards is the other facts and circumstances test is, do we have a contractual commitment to take substantially all the output at a price which is expected to meet the obligations of the entity in the normal course of business? That is what I'm taking away when I add up all these questions. So the pricing doesn't matter except to the extent that it's part of the adequacy of the cash flows to meet the liabilities. The nature of the output doesn't matter. Third-party financing, none of that matters. I mean, if that's actually what's really intended, I think that is easily solvable. We can either clarify that through an agenda decision or amend IFRS 11 to say that's what this other facts and circumstances test actually is. But if we are actually, if we really mean other facts and circumstances more broadly, then I think things like the price at which the output is sold is relevant, not just to the adequacy of the cash flows, but because that affects the transference of risk between the parties and the investee, clearly. The nature of the outputs, if we're dealing with a wind farm, then inventory risk is clearly not going to be an issue. So I don't know whether those things matter or not, because I'm still not quite clear on whether we're really just dealing with a sort of fairly narrow exemption to the basic classification principles in IFRS 11, or dealing with something which is asking you to look a bit more at who's really got the risks and the economic benefits associated with the activity of the investee. You know, when it comes on to, are we doing paper 5B now or doing that?
Might as well.
When it comes on to paper 5B and these project entities, does the fact that actually the parties might be doing all the work, so creating the asset before it's maybe continuously sold to the investee in order to be brought back, does that matter or not? Well, it might matter if we're looking at who's got the risks in relation to the asset. It doesn't matter if we're looking at a yes or no question, do we have the right type of purchase commitment?
Tony?
I also, I think, have a concern or a question about where all this is going. And I just wonder where we end up and where there might be unintended consequences for people that have already adopted this standard in different parts of the world.
I don't actually necessarily disagree with any of the staff's analysis in 5A or 5B, except I think in one point, I think at one point they probably end up reflecting the form and not the substance of an arrangement. But by and large, I can see how they get to where they get to. But I wonder if there's a danger here we're going to end up effectively setting GAAP or embedding an interpretation in some examples. Because I'm not sure that the messages come through clearly from the standard, and I'm not sure that I can pull a clear principle from where the staff's gone. And I think there's a risk that we're going to sort of replace the question we had, which is what's other facts and circumstances all about, with here's a new concept that we can't quite tie back to a principle called inferred rights and inferred obligations. And is our next question, well, what's an inferred right and what's an inferred obligation? And we're not necessarily getting back to, well, really, what did the board mean when it wrote IFRS 11? And I listened to what Lucas said and what Martin said, and how quickly their minds turn to what happens in their industries and how they'd need to add something to these examples or tweak these examples to get an answer. And what he said in his paper, here are 10 variations, or we've got two other people lining up to give us examples. Does this mean that if we answer 5B, then whichever one he's got we get next, then we get Lucas' questions, then we get Martin's questions, and do we have an example at every meeting for the next 2 years? Does it mean that we end up challenging what folks in Canada have already done? Because they've had to make these judgments without any input from the committee or the board. And I just wondered if in some way we need to get back to what's the principle here. And I reflect on something that Alan said at the last meeting. It's that the board expected joint operations within entities to be a fairly narrow subset. They didn't expect it to happen very often. And I wonder that rather than the committee either trying to interpret or draft examples, we might be better saying to the board, what did you mean by other facts and circumstances? Did you mean something that is very narrow? It applies only when the parties are obligated to take all the outputs, so they've got an ongoing obligation for the liabilities, the way Wanhee's paper suggests. Or did you mean something that's a bit wider than that? And you think about some of the other factors that I think people have suggested around the purpose and design and the intent of the parties. And so I'm just a bit concerned, and maybe it's your concern, we'll have one of these a meeting. And whether a better answer is to say, let's stop picking off IFRS 11 issues piecemeal and say to the board, what did you mean? Could you clarify the principle for people?
I will have hung myself from the yardarm by the time we get to the point of having one of these every meeting.
That's my concern about where we are. And just listening to Luca and Martin immediately go to other examples. That's why I'm concerned.
Reinhardt?
Just picking up what Tony was saying is consistent with what
my thinking is, although reading through the paper, I think the construct and the analysis makes sense, one of the concerns I have is that some of the implicit assumptions, you can't tell whether that's critical to the conclusion or not. So, for example, in paragraph 39B, one of the assumptions was that the contractual arrangement between the parties to use substantially all the output of the capacity of the plant, which is aligned to the useful lives of the equipment. I mean, the fact that that capacity is aligned with the useful life and the contractual arrangement is aligned with the useful life, is that critical to the conclusion? And so that kind of gets to the point I think that Tony was making, what variations in practice will arise, and how does that affect the conclusion? And so I am also concerned that although, as I say, this construct I find useful, but to apply it to specific facts and circumstances, we may end up getting a number of these over time to deal with, and so perhaps the better approach is to take it back to the board and seek clarification of what was meant and what the principles were behind other facts and circumstances.
Kaz?
I have an exact concern as Tony said. I can understand. I think the staff analysis is very helpful and useful to make a judgment, but it's actually the ultimately the judgment. So the question I had originally was providing the more illustrative examples can help the preparers to make a judgment whether that the project entity can be the joint operation or joint entity. So that in that sense, as long as that illustration examples help, the notion of the judgment would be helpful, but otherwise it open up to more questions in a case by case and how you apply this example or to my case or some of the things. So I think maybe we may just go back to the board to ask for the clarification of the principles or notion of the application.
I'm looking to the board members, who are all kind of staring.
Why don't you commit the board? We do. You can commit the board. You have much time.
Philippe, board member privilege.
Well, only my personal view. I don't know whether my colleagues will share it, but I think what is a bit unfortunate is that in general we tend to say that substance over form is a better principle than form over substance. And here we have a standard which says whenever you have a legal entity, the presumption is that whatever the type of legal entity, in most cases it is a joint venture and not a joint operation. However, other facts and circumstances may lead you to conclude that substance over form, you should ignore the legal entity to decide whether it is a joint operation. And what is unfortunate is that the standard is drafted in a way that we give only one case, one example of other facts or circumstances when the parties take the output. And it is not really introduced as being one possible example among many others. It is as if it was the only case that the board considers to be when you can override the legal form, which I think personally is a bit too short. I mean, if we think that substance should override legal form in certain cases, why is it that we have only such a case or no other ones? So I think in the end, personally, I think the board should be asked or should be suggested by IFRIC to examine, after you have looked at a couple of examples, real-life examples, whether it would not be a good idea to examine other possible situations to decide whether we should add to the example output taken by the parties some other situations, or whether it is better to restrict and then to say clearly, and more clearly than we say today, that is the only case where you can override the legal form. No other situation. But today there is some uncertainty, in my opinion, as to this case of output taken by the parties is the only case what the board had in mind. I don't remember the board having really discussed much other situations, and I personally have a view that we should open it up a little bit more to respect this notion of substance over form. But I think the work of the committee might help me, having had your views on those situations, to maybe decide on what we should do.
Scott? I was perhaps making an inappropriate assumption that the principles that underlie these examples in this analysis are what the board meant. But taking that, I was concerned at how we were going to do this through examples, just as others were. Because you can come up with lots of industries that would have relevant structures. At some point, there's too many examples for any of this to make sense. It sounds like the examples might be better as educational material rather than added to the standard. I did think it would be good for us somehow, and again, I was presuming that the principles underlying this analysis are what the board meant. I thought it would be good for us to try to find a way to enumerate a few things. You know, number one, I think we concluded, and I don't see anything that contradicts that, that the other facts and circumstances need to create rights to the assets and obligations to the liabilities. It can't be enough to say, well, in the ordinary course, we think that they'll fund the liabilities, even though there's no obligation to do so. That wouldn't be enough. I believe we decided that. There has to be rights and obligations. Also to mention that we know that any structure where we have venturers, they will have some rights and obligations, but in order to actually get to a joint operation, it needs to be rights and obligations, as you said in the paper, Wanhee, that are gross, not net. So rights to the net assets, not enough. I hadn't thought through how we might enumerate these couple things, whether it needs to be an amendment to the standard, or in a rejection notice, or in an interpretation. But I thought enumerating a few of those points, but then holding off on the examples, might be a way to help the situation somewhat without getting to questions like Reinhardt proposed. Well, what if I have one different fact than in the example? What does that happen? And what about my industry? My industry is not covered, so what do I do? Inevitably, when we try to do it by examples, that will happen. So I prefer to try and stay away from that if we can.
Patricia?
I just wanted to say that I more or less agree with Philippe. I think before the committee assumes that the points enumerated in the agenda paper are the principles that the board had in mind, we should take that to the board and double check before you spend too much time trying to do it, because I'd hate to see you spend a lot of time and energy conscientiously trying to come up with examples that meet the principles and then have the board say, but those weren't the principles.
That's a consummation to be avoided. Laurence?
Well, first of all, I think we need to thank the staff for the work he did, because he tried to bring some light and explain what does it mean to have rights to assets, what are the characteristics of the rights, not just get the economic benefits, but also be exposed to the risks associated with the asset. I think that this is a good reminder of what does it mean to have rights to the assets. I agree that, what constituents have always asked is whether the example that is in the standard at the moment is the only example where it would work out to classify the joint arrangement as a joint operation. by reading the staff paper, I understand that we can have a case where instead of purchasing output, the partners are leasing. But other than these two cases, I'm not sure that I've heard other cases where this would work. And this comes, this makes me think that, in fact, what seems to be key in the demonstration as well is that as long as you receive cash from third parties, you cannot demonstrate. You can never demonstrate that you are in a joint operation, if I understand correctly. So every time, if I read the paper, then I was listening to Luca and his examples, and he was saying, okay, but what's the difference? And particularly when you have fungible items, and you have your pipeline, and instead of you being purchasing at what's at the end of the pipeline, you just have a contract 1 meter after you have purchased what is it out of the pipeline, 1 meter after you have a contract to say, well, now I'm selling it to the parties, and it's exactly the same thing. How does that affect that the cash in is coming from you or from the parties? But from what I read from the paper and how it should be analyzed, and this gross analysis that was mentioned, I think these are key elements that are really enlightening. What I would put on agenda paper 5B, I think that in paragraph 12, perhaps on page 5, you have dismissed the features of those transactions or entities, features A to D, a little bit quickly, saying that they do not affect the parties' rights to economic benefits of the assets and obligation to acquire those economic benefits, you know, where actually those facts demonstrate that those legal entities have no autonomy. This is really what is at crux of the debate and what those constituents are arguing, and it's dismissed a little bit too quick, and they will argue against that. The last point I would make is, yes, indeed, some countries have already adopted IFRS 11, but you still have a bunch of companies that will adopt IFRS 11 in 2014, at least most of Europe, except for the FPIs, will apply IFRS 11 in 2014. So there is still some uncertainty out there about how IFRS 11 should be applied. And so anything that can be done to give a hint of the direction in the near future would really be helpful. That is at least before the interim financial statements, the June interim financial statements. So yes, we can recommend to go back to the IASB. Yes, we can think about what we want to do. But I would recommend that if we know where we are going, and I'm hearing that many people were sharing the analysis or the outcome of the analysis that were made here, this should be stated somewhere, because this would be helpful for implementing the standard.
Jean, then I'm going to go to the phones. Then I have maybe a question for Alan. I'm not sure I still do. But.
Well, I'm going back to the board on the meaning of other facts and circumstances. For me, it doesn't make much sense, because I think the choice of words means a lot. If it means to be narrow, why choose other facts and circumstances, which is wide open? And for me, other facts and circumstances mean substance over form. It's very clear. I don't know why I would go to the board and ask, what do you mean with that? Otherwise, that's a very unfortunate choice of word, right? So the paper comes with inferred rights and inferred obligations, which when I saw that, I said, wow, what's inferred rights compared to rights if it's not a substance over form? So in substance, you have rights which is fine to me. I mean, that's okay. But I think we should start with that. The standard says go to substance over form. So if you have, in essence, rights and obligations, which are not strictly legal direct link to the obligation, direct link to the rights of the asset, then this is a joint operation. So I think what we are trying to do is we're trying to go through all sorts of fact pattern. And I thought we already said that we don't want to address specific situation, but maybe it's okay to do it to illustrate what an inferred right might be. But that's it. I mean, I think we should refrain from going anywhere else and to be too specific about which facts and circumstances give you inferred right. Basically, just go with the substance and it's a matter of judgment. I don't think the committee should be stepping in and say, well, you know, if you have A, B, C, and D, that is inferred right. But then the question again comes, well, what if instead of C, I have C1?
Yeah.
So for me, I would refrain and I would stay on the principle. And if we're not comfortable that other facts and circumstances mean substantial reform, then okay, let's go to board. But I think for me, it's obvious. So I would rather say, you know, it's substantial reform, and it's a question of facts, and just look at it. But it has to create rights and obligations. Maybe that's what we need to explain or come back with. And I think we agreed on that. It has to create obligation and rights, and in substance you may have these obligation and rights even though legally you don't have strictly an obligation to satisfy the debt payment.
Chung Wu, board member.
Thank you. I absolutely agree with John, your point. You know, I prefer your suggestion rather than another approach to know what they're both thought when they developed the IFRS 11, because I was not there, so I don't know. But the thing is, if the IFRS has come out, it's a kind of a public knowledge, regardless of what intent when those board members when they developed the standards at the, because the board members are changing every time. So it seems to me the literal the writing of the IFRS is very important. So if the interpretation committee's members do not think that the current standard is not right in applying for real situations, so if you think the board members need to improve the current standards, then as you said, then give us a direct advice, a suggestion to improve some specific paragraph, some specific standard, rather than speaking, approaching softly, smoothly. You know, we should, you know, consult with the ISB to know what their real original intentions when they develop their standards. So my point is, you know, we need to, board members must need to listen to your suggestions, your difficulties in applying for in real world. So please feel free to give us all kinds of suggestions if the current standards have some problems about some kind of some weaknesses, then we are open to change, improve every standard here. That's one. So I really happy to hear John's comments, you know. That's what I'd like to hear. Thank you.
Leap, did you want to come in again?
I like what has been said by Jean and Chung Wu, but I still believe that I would be very happy to have a suggestion or recommendation from this committee as to whether it would be better to introduce paragraph B31 of the standard by the words by example or for example, instead of having a B30 which opens up a little bit and say subset of a form, and then the B31 which closes down and say can be read as being only when, because when the paragraph says that when the parties have, this indicates, that doesn't tell me it is an example, it tells me it is a criteria for applying B30. Well, I can read it this way. I can also try to read it saying it's an example, but usually when it's an example, we say it is an example. So I think this, to me, the link between B30 and B31 doesn't really tell me how I should combine the two. And I would prefer if we were clear as a board on this, whether this is just an example to illustrate what kind of facts or circumstances, or whether it is a criteria to apply B30. So I would be quite happy to have a suggestion or recommendation from this committee as how to proceed, and then we could maybe proceed through an annual improvement, because adding two words might be seen as an annual improvement. Well, the staff would have to assess whether it is a significant change in practice or not, but as practice has not yet quite developed, except Canada, maybe it's maybe easier to do it now this way.
Charlotte, you've been waiting patiently.
Oh yeah, no. All I want to say is I agree with John's analysis. I think it's substance over form. And I'm not sure if the detailed examples actually clarify that or just would add confusion as to whether you were in one example or out of it, exactly whether the terms met, you know, requirements in that. And I think the clarification that would be helpful is that the distinction between gross rights and net rights and obligations is a sort of the key thing to look at, whether you have gross obligations or gross rights to that asset, that liability, which I think is the clarification that's possibly helpful.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Fei Long?
Yes. The staff is attending to add more illustrative examples on classification of joint arrangements to IFRS 11. But it seems to me it doesn't seem to be very helpful in clarifying the distinction between joint operation and joint venture. And I have a couple of observations on this paper. Is it proper to refer to the first bullet point in example 5, when analysis in fair right? In paragraph 13, the analysis says first bullet point side above from example 5 indicate that the parties to the joint arrangement need have to an obligation to purchase all the output of a separate vehicle so that to have inferred right to the asset. However, readers may think that the first bullet point side in example 5 is actually focusing the party's obligation to fund the settlement of the liabilities and thus share the liabilities of joint arrangement rather than talking about the share of assets. Paragraph 32, example 3, is on a situation where the parties have a symmetrical put and call option to buy substantially all output from the joint arrangement. From the inferred right to asset, whether the pricing for option will have impact on the analysis. If it is a fair value price, then the risk of the asset of the entities are not transferred to the joint arrangement parties until the exercise of the option. Also, it is not that in paragraph 24B in the paper, it mentions the risk relating to economic benefits when assessing inferred rights. Paragraph 54, if the nature of the output is so specific to P and Q, there's no one else in the market can use the output under this situation, even if the contractual terms do not require P and Q to purchase the output. But in substance, entity I can also sell goods to P and Q. How would that affect the analysis of inferred rights and inferred liabilities? given the above observation. On those questions from if remembered, I think that more implementation guidance may be necessary. But just like some of the other members' opinion, that we are better to ask the board before decide what and how and where we would like to go. Thank you.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the last meeting we discussed that other facts and circumstances needed to give rise to rights and obligations. That was our view of the requirements of IFRS 11, and what we asked the staff to do was to go away and do an analysis of how do other facts and circumstances create those rights and obligations. I actually think the papers do a very good job of explaining that and bringing out the types of factors that should be considered and how the analysis should be performed. I think the conclusions in paragraphs 37 and 38 about when do you have inferred rights and inferred obligations are particularly useful. And it seemed to me that somehow incorporating those into the standard or incorporating those as part of how you assess rights and obligations arising from other facts and circumstances would be beneficial. I'm sort of a bit concerned about all the discussion about substance over form, because I'm not quite sure whether people think that's an alternative to rights and obligations. In other words, you don't have to look for rights and obligations in facts and circumstances. You can stand back and say, well, the substance is we have rights to the assets and obligations for the liabilities. To me, you either have rights and have obligations or you don't have them, and that's what's critical in determining whether this is a joint operation. I don't like the term inferred rights and inferred obligations. I think they're actual rights to the economic benefits and actual obligations to settle the liabilities of the entity on a continuous basis. But I do know the paper just says it's using that term for the purpose of the paper. I wouldn't continue with that term in any pronouncements. I am concerned with the similar concern you expressed at the beginning. I noted that there were sort of eight variations that it was indicated we might look at going forward. You could probably double and triple that number of fact patterns that we might be asked to look at for either inclusion of examples or to provide interpretive guidance. I don't think we should go down that path. I do think we should try to distill out of this paper some of the key principles which Scott referred to, and I think they would be helpful in actually aiding people to interpret what's meant by other facts and circumstances and how they give rise to rights and obligations. On agenda paper 5B, I agree with the staff analysis. I think that's how I would have assessed it under IFRS 11. But I do think we need to confirm with the board that our thinking on how rights and obligations are assessed is correct before we ask the staff to go away and develop illustrative examples for the standard.
Thank you, John. Julie, anything?
Yes. This will sound a little bit like an echo, but it seems like all along he's good work was necessary to better illustrate what's at stake here. But now, in terms of helping people, what would really be helpful is just the key takeaways from having dived into all the details and somehow communicating those, whether that communication is in a interpretation or an amendment or some other form, probably to be determined. But it seems like the committee has sort of done the hard work of digging into several examples on behalf of all the issuers that eventually will apply this and has some learnings from that, and the value they could add is to somehow communicate those key takeaways.
Thank you, Julie. Laurence, did you want to come back in?
Well, I think it's just going to reiterate what John said. John has pointed to what has been summarized in paragraph 37 and 38 of agenda paper 5A. I think that what is written in paragraph 24, particularly the last bit, is really important. Well, the last bit illustrates what is written in paragraph 24, and what is written in paragraph 26 and 29 are really key points, and detail a little bit more what is in paragraph 37 and 38. And this is where we would need to make sure that this is what the board has in mind or not. Because as John said, when he expressed concerns about the discussion about substance over form, I can tell you that many people interpret substance over form differently. And the key question that has been raised in practice, what does it mean to have rights to assets in a joint arrangement and obligation to the liabilities in a joint arrangement? So this is really what needs to be clarified.
Alan?
Thanks, Wayne. I think what I'm going to say is consistent with something Julie said as well. I think the incredible value that's added is actually in thinking of the examples as helping identify the problem as opposed to a solution. So I'm worried if we said that the idea was to get these illustrative examples and add those to the standard, then that's the more successful we are and more helpful we are, then the more problematic it is, because we're now interpreting GAAP and we're creating I4S through examples. So that's where we got ourselves into a year or so ago. We've got to avoid doing that again. I think the real benefit is the examples highlight where the things are absolutely clear and where things are uncertain. And I think the last meeting of this Interpretations Committee, by going through some examples, identified that you have to have rights and obligations. And the draft rejection notice that we'll consider, I think, next month, the next meeting, if we confirm that, that will make a substantive step forward for us to clarify. Sorry, you can't see this, Julie, but it's a narrowing down before we start to widen about what other facts and circumstances actually means. Where can this committee add value? I think in several areas. One is, I'd actually think that it would be helpful to continue to develop some of these examples so that we can identify and pass those to the board. Because I think if the board saw, the committee said, look, here's a real example where we don't know what the answer is because we think there's a lack of clarity in here, then the ISB can actually take some action to try and resolve that. If you simply come to the board and say, did you mean narrow or wide? I think they'd probably like to see some examples to say, well, give us some examples where you're concerned about this. So I think the examples are not the solution. They're helping with the problem identification. I think the committee can also add tremendous value by taking the 27 or so issues and quickly dismissing some of those that can be simply put aside as saying, you know what, these are just issues. We came and sought problems from you. There's a big difference between me complaining about the hotel service and somebody ringing me up and asking me what I thought of the service. I'm more likely to tell them about little problems here and there if somebody asks me point blank. We went out and solicited feedback on IFRS 11, so I think the barrier was quite low. Some of these things, the issues I saw on the list of 27, were clearly deal with those. You know, they're just practice will develop as well. The other problem I see is that if there are genuine uncertainties in the standard, solving them by having illustrative examples means that I think if you're auditing those things, it's telling somebody you got that wrong. Whereas if the board needs to solve a problem, the board can actually solve a problem by changing the standard, and it is a change that causes practice to change, as opposed to simply some example tried to buffer people in. Now, I worry about restatements around the world where it's just through some sort of illustrative example. So I think this is multiple threads. One is the rejection notices can be very helpful. If there is a way we could do the gross versus net by clearly seeing some words in IFRS 11 that helped us there, that might be another peg along there. Then the other issue is helping the board by saying, look, these are the two or three areas where we think you might need to step in and make some changes. And we've got the examples there to help us make those decisions. So I've always said that the advantage of this group is that you're out there working with these words. If you can actually help us identify examples where there clearly is a problem as opposed to solving the examples, I think that's far more helpful.
It's not quite the way I would have looked at it, but that's not unusual.
No, it was just
I wrote down three things here, and maybe two of them converge on one another. First question I wrote down, or first word I wrote down with a question mark was entity. And Tony reminded us that at the last meeting, Alan said that the board thought it would be unusual for a joint operation to be housed in an entity. Flip side of that is that in the legal jurisdiction that I came from, every joint operation is by definition a legal entity. It's a partnership. Matter of fact, you have to file an election not to be required to file a partnership tax return. So entity must have meant, I infer, something that has the effect of limiting liability, i.e. a corporation, or, and here I get to the point Charlotte raised, even in a partnership, I don't have gross rights in all circumstances. I have net rights. My partner's capital account is a net right. I don't get to go in and take the typewriters. So I think that's been one focus of our discussion, is the role of entity. The second focus has clearly been this whole question of other rights and obligations. Does it mean substance over form, which is kind of a squishy, jello-y sort of a notion to some of us, or does it mean there has to be something out there that creates assets and liabilities?
And can I just confirm, you're referring to other facts and circumstances?
Other facts and circumstances. What did I say?
Other rights and obligations.
Oh, okay. No, I was referring to other facts and circumstances and jumping ahead to my bias about what it means. So it seems to me that those two things have been the focus of a lot of our discussion. I do agree with Alan that you have to go through the examples and suffer through that process to really maybe get the appreciation that we need. I am reluctant to go to the board with a paper the size and shape of the ones that we have today, because the board members have shown some impatience with getting that kind of analysis. I would propose that we try to develop an elevator explanation. You know, the old principle that you ought to be able to get in an elevator and explain what your problem is between the ground floor and the top floor. And
pardon me?
So I would like to propose, I take the view of the committee that we ought to get the board to explain what may have been purposeful ambiguity, which has a long tradition in standard setting. But if it is, then we need to understand that. So I would propose that we do consult with the board, but that we do so on a more compressed basis. And that we say, look, we've been looking at examples. We'd be happy to share them with you if you all want them. But they all point us to this specific issues. Scott?
On the matter of substance over form, rights and obligations, gross and net, we've been throwing around these terms. I'm not sure that we're actually using them in a way that is contradictory. I'm going to paraphrase what I think Jean said, and by all means, if I get it wrong, somebody tell me, but I think we're in a situation where if we are looking at other facts and circumstances, we have already determined that the legal form and the contractual rights do not in form give rights to the assets and obligations yep. for the liabilities. Because if they did, we don't have to go to other facts and circumstances. So we already know that in form, they don't create rights to asset and obligations for liabilities. So the other facts and circumstances is to tell us whether in substance we have rights and obligations, even though in form we do not. So it's not, substance over form isn't meant to say I don't need rights and obligations. Rather, it's like to that. Say the form doesn't give me rights and obligations, the substance does. And then we can, you know, how far do you want to go in providing examples of how that might happen? That's another question. But John, am I correct in the way you're yeah. using substance over form?
Okay. Okay, that's what we'll do then. We will consult with the board. We will try to do so without inflicting all of our analysis on them.
We will. I mean, you know, one whose paper, I think, did a great job in Ed. Taking us through the thought process and the analysis to come to certain conclusions. And what we need to do is to obviously take a synopsis of that and the input from the board from the committee members here to a concise paper to the board.
Philippe? A question about the timing. I think Ronnie is also developing a very good paper for the next IFRIC meeting on another case or fact pattern, which I think is worth looking at before you take all the package to the board, whatever package you take to the board, or shall you, or will you do it before this discussion? Or personally, I think I would like, as a board, to have also the benefit from your discussion of the next paper that one is developing. I'm not sure whether one can make it for the May meeting, but...
Well, that means that you're not going to be able to discuss it at a board meeting until June or July.
I know that. I know that, but I think we have to weigh the benefits and drawbacks of that. I think this analysis... Well, what's your feeling, Michael, about the value of having this discussion before taking to the board?
That other example or couple of examples would be to just illustrate, test, if you like, the conclusions that had already been drawn. Yes, that'd be very helpful, but I'm also hearing concerns about progress being made in advance of half-year results being published.
Let's be realistic. Even if the board, as a first discussion, say in June or July, that will not be conclusive. Unlikely to be conclusive. And will the preparers get any real indication from that first discussion of at the board to be able to prepare their June 30 first accounts playing IFRS 11? I'm not quite sure.
Okay, let's try and bring this to a conclusion. Lawrence?
Can we just get a hint about what is being addressed in that other paper? Or what type of fact pattern is addressed in that other paper?
What we're referring to is what one here had included in Appendix A on Paper 5B. So that is where you've got a project entity with, for example, two partners and just one customer, and it's a sort of bespoke sort of civil engineering type project mm-hmm. that is being constructed for that one particular customer, which contrasts with the main example that we had in 5B, which was more a case of constructing something for multiple customers without such a high degree of bespoke specification.
To get to different conclusions, because I thought that Agenda Paper 5A would address any type of project entities, so was addressing both
the idea was
the case you described. So perhaps I've been misled if you get to different conclusions.
The idea was to test whether or not we do get to a different conclusion.
And so far?
But we've not done it yet, so.
Okay. What are you going to do with the other 27 issues? Because I'm trying to work out, you said if we take this to the board now, do we continue to come back for the next?
What we've done with the other 27 issues is that in the November paper,
we recast those in terms of the primary issues and the secondary issues, and then we recast it again for January. So no, we don't have any plans to bring back those original issues. What they did was inform us to identify what the key issues are, and that's so we've done that filtering already.
So they're closed?
Yes.
Okay, John, I really want to wrap this up, so let's...
Yeah, sorry for coming back. It's because Scott's trying to interpret what I was trying to say, and maybe just to bring a nuance, I think what we are trying to reconcile here is how do we have obligation, substance over form, it means that there can be an intention or it's structured in the way that it's intended that the parties will pay for the obligation. And then we try to reconcile substance over form with a right and obligation, which seems to contradict one another. So I think the only way to get there is that under the substance over form, and if you want to have an infer right or an infer obligation, you have to demonstrate a cascading. The cash flow has to cascade through legal obligation to the debt. So I have an obligation to pay for the output. So I put the cash in the joint venture. The joint venture has an obligation to pay for the debt. So this cascading of obligation gave me inferred obligation for the debt. But I think what we say as a group is that you still need an obligation. In other words, the substance of reform is not the wide-ranging substance of reform that we usually interpret. And I think that's the interpretation in Canada. In Canada, we've taken the position that there has to be obligations. You cannot just say the intent or the scheme is that the parties will support the debt. That wouldn't work. So I'm trying to reconcile the substance of a form with, I think it's substance of a form, but in a very narrow meaning as to create legal obligation for the debt.
That was what I understood to be the point. Okay. So we will consult with the board. We'll leave it to staff judgment about the timing of that.